Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, we are first going to take up briefly the legacy bill, which is House File 2563. We heard it, and the Judiciary Chair should stay at the podium because we're just going to, this is just a procedural motion. We heard this bill yesterday. We laid it over anticipating that it would be a Senate file and that we would be waiting for the Senate to send it, but there has been agreement to move this bill forward as a House file. So we're not going to have discussion to the bill since we heard it yesterday. We're just going to move it now to the General Register. So I will move House File 2563 be sent to the General Register. And unless I'm looking over at my counterpart just to make sure he has no objection to us moving right to a vote, and he does not. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2563 is moved to the General Register. Our first bill up today is House File 2300, the Judiciary Finance Bill, and we have Chair Scott and Liebling at the dais there. Before we get to the introduction, I'm going to turn to nonpartisan staff and ask them just to tell the committee what the target was for this committee and whether the bill is in compliance with the target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So for the Judiciary Finance Committee, the target for fiscal years 26 and 27 was an additional $30 million over the forecast base that was issued in the February forecast. And in the TAILS for fiscal years 28 and 29, the target was an additional $30 million over what was directed in the February forecast base. And it does meet those numbers, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. And this bill we are going to lay over for the moment. So Chair Scott will move to lay over House File 2300. And, Chair Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would note that members will note that we are proceeding quite a bit differently than we did yesterday with the spreadsheets. That's a mutual agreement between me and the co-chair. As I looked around the room yesterday, I noted that there was not necessarily rapt attention to every number on the spreadsheet. We just felt our time would be better used highlighting the target. And if you do have questions about the spreadsheet, members, please feel free to ask them. But we felt it was not necessary to spend as much time on the spreadsheets as we did yesterday, and it's a mutual agreement.
Thank you for that clarification. That's good information for the whole committee to have. So Chair Scott moves to lay over House File 2300. Chair Scott and Liebling, you can present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is an amendment. I feel like maybe we want to take that one up first, the amendment up first.
Sure. It's the A7 amendment. And correct. So Chair Scott moves the A7 amendment. And can you briefly describe the A7 for the committee?
Sure. This amendment removes the uniform law bill that was a part of the omnibus. And we're going to have a better discussion on the merits of that bill next year. And so we thought it best to pull it out for now.
Any discussion to the A7 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the A7 is adopted. And Chair Scott and Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank my co-chair, Representative Liebling, for working diligently and in good faith on this bill. For the judiciary, it is the third branch of government, and we have a duty to fund them. And so I want to thank her for her work on the bill. And this bill, we really tried to have an intentional and thoughtful approach to this. We had a $30 million target, and so the numbers were difficult to reach, but I think that we did a really good job with this. And one of the things we tried to do was try to hold employees' paychecks harmless when it came to additional expenses for health insurance. Health insurance premiums have really gone up this year, and so with some one-time money and some different things, we really tried to hold paychecks harmless to the extent that we could, and so a lot of the funding went towards that. We also were able to reinstate the guardian ad litem volunteer program. There's money in here for two FTEs for that, for training those guardian ad litem, and then there's a report that will be furnished to the legislature regarding the results and how well that program is working. We also did one-time investments to strengthen our judicial system's infrastructure, and will remain available for 4 years. And with that, I would just ask Representative or Chair Liebling if she has anything to add to the bill, to the bill's conversation, and then if staff wants to walk through a spreadsheet with the numbers and through the bill too, that's the chair's call. But go ahead.
Yep. Chair Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Co-Chair Scott. So I concur. It's been a pleasure working together. Of course, we don't agree on everything, but when it comes to funding the judiciary and agencies that are coming under our jurisdiction, I think we have general agreement that this is important to do. And of course, $30 million is a pretty thin target. And I think we did the best we could with that money and distributed it in the way that we thought was fair. And I think we do concur on that. The policy that's in the bill is all just agreed policy, went through committee with really no dissent and has been all worked out. So I think we have a pretty good bill here, and just appreciate the Chair Scott and also the members of our committee on both sides of the aisle who worked diligently to get this done.
Thank you. So we, as Chair Torkelson indicated, we won't be doing a walkthrough of the spreadsheet in the committee, so now is a good time for members to ask questions and have discussion to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Well, I think you have a bunch of happy campers here. There's no discussion to the bill, so you're free to make closing comments if you want. You did just do that. I'm seeing that shaking head. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate members' support. We think that it is a good bill, and yeah, thank you for the hearing this morning.
All right. So with that, Chair Scott renews her motion that House File 2300 as amended be laid over, and the bill is laid over. We'll move next to the Public Safety Finance Bill, House File 2432, and we'll wait for Chairs Novotny and Moeller to make their way to the table. But actually, as they're doing that, maybe I'll turn to Ms. Adrians and ask that she tell the committee what the target was for this committee and if they've met the target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the Public Safety Finance Committee, the target they received was an additional $50 million over the February forecast base for fiscal years 26 and 27. And then in the tails, the target was also an additional $50 million over the base that was established in the February forecast. And they did meet those numbers.
Wonderful. So with that, Chair Novotny moves House File 2432 be recommended for placement on the general register. Chair Novotny, if you want to describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair. As I described, we did have a target of $50 million, but keep in mind that that was against a agency request that are now over $120 million. Most of those are fixed costs that are caused by union negotiated contracts. We did have prioritizing of peace officer training and recruitment with $5.5 million each year to the Philando Castile Training Fund, $500,000 for the first year to the duty to intercede training, and $2 million to the intensive police officer training program, ICPOET, that has been instrumental in fast-tracking many people into the law enforcement career where we are desperately in need of new officers to come into the program. In addition to that, we put $1 million each year to fund local public safety radio equipment called Armor. That's not going to do any of the upgrades that we're going to need desperately, but it will be a Band-Aid in hope of getting us to the next step when that can be fixed. We also included penalty increases that would protect our most vulnerable and those who protect us. Mandatory minimum sentence for first degree criminal sexual trafficking, adding fentanyl to allowing a child or a vulnerable adult to have contact with that to make it same as contact with methamphetamine. Consecutive sentences for assaulting a local jailer that matches what we have for the state correctional officers, increasing the statute of limitation to 10 years for a first degree arson, and a DOC required to maintain Narcan in the prisons. That was $18 million over the above, keeping in mind that 5.5 of that a year was the Philando Castile Fund. Most of those funds have been ongoing. for the past 4 years, but never put in the base. So we're not really spending anything that wasn't part of the base before. And then we have $16 million for crime victim funds, $1.4 million for the BCA fraud unit. It's important to note that there were guardrails that were put into that that protected the mission and purpose of those investigators to honor the funding that comes from the Commerce when those investigators were moved to the BCA. We did have a $3.5 million reduction from the governor's budget for sentence to serve program that was cut, and the remaining $18 million was put back to agency increases. With that, I turn it over to Chair Mueller.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Novotny. Just a couple of things that I'll emphasize that you mentioned already, too. As you said, the operating adjustment, while we're certainly thankful for the target we received, and on paper it looks great compared to some of the other committees, the operating adjustment is still a very much a big concern for our committee. It was $116 million in 26, 27, and $141 in 28 and 29. Again, we got 50 million in each biennium. And as the Department of Public Safety said, it's really going to impact their service levels, things like processing evidence in a timely fashion. And the DOC is the one that takes the biggest hit here. It's paying, it's meeting their contract obligations for corrections officers. It's really going to make the reverse the progress. They've come to about full capacity now with COs being hired, which is great. They were really having trouble retaining and recruiting. And this is really going to put a dent in those efforts, which is important not only to the corrections officers, but to the safety of the people who are incarcerated and their ability to get the programming that they need for rehabilitation. So just want to emphasize that. Yet in spite of that, I think we did a really nice job kind of balancing what the needs were that came to our committee. And do want to highlight victim services being a priority for both of our caucuses. Really appreciate the work with Chair Rarick on the victim services piece. And actually, you'll see in this bill, we've created a special revenue account to try to get some additional funding in. A lot of the victim services funding in the state, these are things like domestic violence shelters, sexual assault advocates, child abuse centers, and general crime advocates, comes from federal dollars. It's been a very unstable source for years. It comes from white-collar crime fines, and that's not a consistent source, and it's been decreasing rather rapidly in recent years. And we have tried in the past biennium to kind of fill those gaps, thinking it would replenish again, and it just doesn't look like that's possible. So we're trying to think creatively in creating this special revenue account to help alleviate some of the needs there. Thank you.
All right. We'll move. There were no amendments, so we'll move to discussion to the bill. Members, questions and discussion to the bill. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, co-chairs, for your good work on this bill. I do have a question. I believe in the last biennium, there was money added to the budget, to the base budget for prisoners' phone calls, and I'm wondering how much that was, and if that were not funded at the full amount, if that would help with the shortfall at the Department of Corrections.
Representative Novotny or Mueller.
I believe we fund $3 million a year for that. I just received a letter from the commissioner last night. I believe about 2.2 of that is going to the actual cost of the calls. And some of the money that was collected in those phone calls would go to offset other costs, cable TV, recreational equipment, things like that. And those are all now being absorbed as a cost from the DOC.
Representative Mueller, if you wanted to comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say that that was a priority for us to fund those costs. We heard in the interim, we had a hearing in December to talk about sort of long-term strategies when it comes to Department of Corrections. And we actually heard from Oklahoma, their Secretary of Public Safety, I think, that this isn't just sort of a thing that the progressives do or Democrats do. That making sure people have those family connections really helps with rehabilitation and also helps children be able to maintain contact with their family members who might be incarcerated. So, we did have this discussion in committee and had some differing opinions about about what we could do with that money, but I think it's really important for rehabilitation of folks to maintain that ability to have those connections with their loved ones.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, and I know it's a larger discussion to see if that is indeed effective, but Chair Novotny, did you say there was another sum of money that was spent on cable television? How much was that?
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. About $1 million a year.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So $1 million a year, I think, would have, yeah, everything counts, and I mean to put something like that towards these correction officers to try to help keep them whole, I think would have been a good move. But it's overall, I'll support the bill, but that's a concern for me. Thank you.
Representative Yuki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you. I know you guys didn't have a huge target, and it barely covers operating costs, and I am too concerned about the Department of Corrections not having enough money to do some of those things that they need to do to make sure the folks that do come out of our system don't recidivate. And that is the big part of the programs that are in our prison systems. It's been a while since I was a CA in Senate, in the other body, judiciary, but if I can remember right, about 85% of the folks that do that are incarcerated end up coming back into our communities. We want to make sure that they're going to be successful so we don't have to pay for their incarceration again. So thank you for maintaining the funding for the phone calls and some of the other things that actually keeping folks educated and busy in our prisons also keeps our guards safe. So just want to thank you for the work that you do.
Any further discussion? Representative Baje.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you again, both Chairs Mueller and Novotny. It's good to see a compromise bill come together. I will just add, again, my thoughts. I think, anything that we can do to help rehabilitate people and make sure that they're successful, I think the phone calls go a long way to that. To the point about cost savings, my understanding is that the FEC has also capped costs for phone calls. So that way, I think not only the state of Minnesota, but other states that also are doing this program should see future cost savings as the years go by, which can be used, I think, for a variety of things to support our Department of Corrections. So thank you again, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, we'll go to closing comments from our two co-chairs. Chair Novotny, do you want to go first, or Chair Mueller?
Sure, I'll go first. This is the first step. I am aware that the DOC is looking on ways that they're going to have to cost cut. This is a way that we're going to take that first step in preparations. Hopefully it won't be as bad as forecast 2 years from now, but there will be cost cutting, and both sides of the aisle, I feel, want to make sure that the people coming out of prisons that we both acknowledge will be coming out are in a position that they can become productive members of society, and I hope that we continue to work to preserve that.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to thank Co-Chair Novotny again for working together on this. All our staff, too, on both sides of the aisle, nonpartisan staff, did a really great job, and it's a good bill, and I hope you all can support it. Thank you.
All right, with no further discussion on House File 2432, we're now going to have a series of motions to merge the two bills before voting on the Public Safety and Judiciary Bill as a combined entity. So first, Chair Scott, would you move that the language from House File 2300 as amended be incorporated into the Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus as separate articles?
That's my motion, Mr. Chair.
All right, any discussion to the Scott motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Chair Mueller, would you move that the language from House File 2432 be incorporated into the Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus as separate articles?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the Mueller motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And with that, Chair Novotny renews his motion that House File 2432, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections to amend the title. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 2432, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Thank you to the co-chairs. Next, we will take up the Housing Finance Bill. House File 2445 Chairs Igo and Howard. And as they make their way to the table, we'll have turned to Ms. Adrians to ask what was the target for this committee and is the bill in compliance with the target?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the Housing Finance Committee, the target this year, they received an additional $75 million for fiscal years 26 and 27. And then the target in the tails was an additional $7.6 million over base for 28 and 29. And the bill is in compliance with these targets.
Members, the next three bills have been agreed upon to be Senate files, so the motion will be to lay the bill over, and we will vote them out once we've received the bills from the Senate. So the motion from Chair Igo will be to lay over House File 2445. And Chair Igo, if you'd like to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, House File 2445 is a good housing bill. I want to thank Chair Howard and I. We did some good work on this bill. When we started working in this committee, I just want to say three things that are really important about housing, in that the fact is this state as a whole is 106,000 housing units down. The average age of buying your first home is 38 years old, and the average mortgage is over $2,500 a month. The bill that's in front of us today is a bill that's going to take a step in fixing some of those issues. We worked really collaboratively together to come up with a bill that not only just focuses on brick and mortar of building more homes, but we also focused on things to keep people in their homes. We believed in three main pillars when we were working on this bill about how we need to have diverse housing options. We need to have stable housing options. We need to have affordable housing options. The bill in front of us today does that, and it does that in a way that's going to make record investments in places that matter and deliver the tools to communities and to places across this state, not only just here in St. Paul and Minneapolis, but also to the outstate as well. So it's a really good bill, clean policy, and really took the priorities of our committee. I do have to brag a little bit. I think we're the only committee that was able to pass every single bill on a voice vote. We had no roll call votes, and I think that shows a collaboration between our sides on a top three issue for all Minnesotans.
Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. This is a bill that will do a lot of good for Minnesotans across the state of Minnesota. As Chair Igo mentioned, Minnesota does face an unprecedented and worsening housing crisis. More than 600,000 Minnesotans are cost burdened, meaning they're paying more than 30% of their income in housing. We have a 100,000 unit housing gap, a shortage that is one of the worst in the nation. And with this bill, as Chair Igo mentioned, will provide investments in places that will have direct and tangible benefits for Minnesotans. To highlight a few pieces, this bill includes more than $30 million for emergency rental assistance through the Family Homelessness Prevention Assistance Program. This is the program that provides assistance in all 87 counties and will mean that thousands of families that would have been homeless can stay safe and stable in their homes. And we're also targeting investments that will build homes on that range of housing that Chair Igo mentioned, from affordable multifamily all across the state, affordable single-family homes, manufactured housing. We're focusing on areas of need where there are shortages and ability to build. And the last thing I'll mention, the debt service for $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds. This is our state's bread and butter tool to build more units of housing, especially units of housing that's more affordable for folks. And again, it's a flexible tool to build single-family, multifamily housing, manufactured housing. And so this build will build more homes, and it will help more families stay stable, and I want to echo Chair Igo's words about our bipartisan collaboration. I think whether you live in a red district, a blue district, greater Minnesota, or the metro area, housing stability is foundational for all of our families, and we were able to take that shared understanding as a way for us to work forward, and it's a bill that I think all of us can be very proud of.
There were no amendments submitted for the bill, so we'll move to discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the authors of the bill for your good work. I just want to highlight one of the provisions of the policy portion of your bill. I guess it's subdivision 22 on page 12, lined 12.24, it starts. The prioritization of competitive development program awards. And while I understand it was given
conversation in committee and ability for testimony, which is great. I think that in our legislative committee-based process, this wasn't given the opportunity. This was introduced late and not sent to committee. I think it would have likely gone to the local government committee. And so I have concerns about the process with which it was brought in. I think that legislation is always better when we have more opportunities and more stakeholders to comment on and shape policy. And so I will just voice my concern about the process with which this provision was added to the bill.
And I don't know if Chairs Igo or Howard want to comment on that. Chair Howard.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Acorn, I just wanted to highlight what that provision is and does for committee members and the public. This provision would provide an incentive for scoring through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency projects for projects that reside in cities that have adopted one of a set of pro-housing supply policies that make it easier to build more homes. It isn't a mandate, but provides a carrot, if you will, in the scoring process for housing. What I'd say about just the legislative process piece, the balance of our committee's entire work this session has been on how do we address our housing shortage, how do we build more homes. So we did hear a series of bills on these topics, and this is a provision born out of those conversations, and we continue to welcome feedback as the process moves forward.
Representative Igo.
I'll just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just dovetail off that. The ideas that are in this section that you're referring to, Representative Akam, have been talked about broadly in our committee, and actually working with stakeholders, this is one of the things we came to as two co-chairs to add into our bill is that carrot approach.
Representative Akam.
Thank you. I'll just respond that I think that this provision would have benefited from going to local government. And so while there was a lot of conversation, there wasn't conversation in the appropriate committees. Thank you.
Representative Baja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Chairs Igo and Howard. Again, I was on the committee, so I saw the process for this bill. I think, we came to what we could do with the target that we had. And so I think we are definitely doing a lot to continue to preserve housing, build new housing across the state of Minnesota, and start to make a dent in our housing crisis. I just want to highlight that, I think this will help us along the way as we are anticipating and also seeing some of the cuts happening right now at the federal government level, particularly when it comes to rental assistance, when it comes to preventing homelessness. So we do have strategies for that in our budget to ensure that we're trying to keep as many people housed as possible. I think also, the approach that you guys are taking towards ensuring that we're building more housing across Minnesota, I think is a fair one. I think is one that is incremental. I myself would like to see something further, but I understand not everyone is at the same place where we are. But I do think that this incremental approach that has been had multiple discussions, has been viewed multiple times, has been seen by the stakeholders that are most invested in how we continue to build more housing, not only in our cities, but in our rural areas, in our suburban areas, to ensure that everyone can find that place that they want to call home, and to also ensure that our builders have the ability to build the types of homes that people are actually requesting of them. So I know there's still a lot of work to be done there. I would say myself on housing, I think there's still a number of areas that we could provide additional investment. I'll call out the manufactured housing piece as well, too. I think we're, doing some good work to keep up with our residents and our manufactured homes. But I appreciate you guys' efforts to ensuring that we are introducing some more stability and predictability in our housing market. So thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the co-chairs, I will say to you, there are lots of pieces in this bill that I absolutely love. And I would say 90%, 99% of this bill I can support. That's awesome. Again, going to this last adopted amendment, which is now the Article 3 housing policy in the bill. This piece gives me great pause. And it's not because I disagree with the intention that was so well laid out by Representative Abaje. I think all of those intended outcomes are awesome. But I have to look at the language of the bill itself. And the language of the bill is what gives me pause. So for example, if the goal is to allow more affordable housing, there is nothing in this article that would require any type of affordable piece. So it doesn't even require the developers who would be benefiting from these things to pass on that affordability to the end consumer, right? That's not here. When I look at things like lines 12.29, where it says that, I'll just go to lines 12.24 to 12.31. And it's the prioritization of the competitive development program awards. While one of the letters that was submitted in our packets says that there is no harm, it does an advantage. Well, it does advantage. Cities of the first class, many of them already do these things that you are listing here because they can, right? So suburban cities would be at a disadvantage. Greater Minnesota cities would be at a disadvantage. And I hear the argument they just have to pick one. But you are saying that these are the only things that people can do. And it doesn't take in the other parts of the equation about affordability, right? It doesn't talk about what jobs are available, what wages are being paid, any of those other pieces of the equation that affect housing affordability. It just strips cities of the opportunity to be able to compete competitively for money, okay? It's money that makes housing happen. If I move on then to line, so it says, the commissioner shall develop a scoring system which awards additional points. Well, I looked in the statutes to say, how are points awarded currently? Well, there are no points in statute. Can't find them anywhere. So now we're going to award additional points for just these things. So cities of the first class will beat out suburban communities every time. Every time. Because they can get more of these points than a city that can't do all of the things. Okay? Then it says, if you move on to line 13.2, if you allow duplexes, accessory dwellings, and townhomes in 75% of the area zoned for single family, that sounds awesome. Let's do it. We'll get more housing. Awesome. But it doesn't make any accommodation for whether wastewater can be accommodated. It makes no accommodation for human safety or any of those other pieces. That causes me pause. But yet, cities of the first class, maybe they can do it. But not all suburban cities that are all developed out could do that. Then it says, if you move on, if you go to line 13.7, where a city, a jurisdiction can't mandate a lot size larger than 1/8. Well, if you are on a septic system, 1/8 doesn't do it for you. So you are disqualified from being able to choose that. And then aesthetic mandates, it sounds wonderful. Let's ban all aesthetic mandates and just make housing cheaper. Well, you know, if you live in an apartment building or a townhome and the only outdoor space you have is that balcony your outdoor space, or is that balcony an aesthetic mandate? What is this actually going to look like when we build houses? You know, the other thing I will say, well, I could say a lot, but I'll just stop. I think I've made my point. And then it says that the commissioner on line 13.13, the commissioner may rely on representation on the website of a municipality. You don't have to have a conversation with the community that you're scoring their grants. It also says that, I want to find one more thing in here that I was upset about. On line 13.3, you add that you have to allow this, you can choose, you're calling it a carrot, you can choose 75% of the area zoned single family and applies the administrative approval process. That was the other piece. So there, you can't have community conversation. It's just an administrative process. So there is a lot in this that needs to be discussed, and it should have been discussed in local government, but I didn't hear those conversations, and this was put on right before the break. So none of us had an opportunity to be together to discuss it prior to it coming into this committee. I just don't like the process that it's happened, and there's a lot that we can discuss. But I want to say, I recognize the goal, but this bill doesn't do it in this format for me. Thank you.
The chair's an opportunity to respond. Chair Howard.
Yeah, I just want to clear up a few pieces. The first one is related to affordability. So what this does is add an additional scoring metric to the existing scoring metric for projects that go through Minnesota Housing. And so affordability, in some instances by the programs, for example, in federal tax credit, that is a mandated piece. So the largest scoring, and most of these programs have affordability requirements. So when we fund programs through, just in this bill, for example, the workforce and affordable home ownership, in order to apply for those funds, you need to have a level of affordability. And so this applies to projects that are, in essence, will be affordable projects. So that's a piece. There was a comment that all of the resources would be going to just Minneapolis or St. Paul to that piece. Again, there, Minnesota Housing Finance Authority, through their QAP process, which is how they lay out for developers the scoring system to award points, regional balance is a critical component of how program dollars are doled out. And in some cases, that trumps the scoring system itself. And so like a project might secure a little bit more points than one, but Minnesota Housing has the ability and often accounts for regional balance so that we have, a balance between greater Minnesota and the metro area. For members that are on our housing committee, every year, MHFA walks through each of their programs and tells us the previous year's grants, how many went in greater Minnesota versus metro, and it's often been very, very balanced. Just one more, Pete, the aesthetic mandate was mentioned as it relates to multifamily. The bill calls out that this is only related to single family in the language. And then just the last point is, again, nothing is mandating a city to do any of these things. They are things that some cities are doing already and using those strategies to build more homes. And so that's why we're taking the ideas that cities have shared with us that are working and providing this incentive, a slight one, through the scoring system for these affordable housing projects that would be built through a myriad of programs.
Chair Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just follow up. My co-chair here kind of hit a lot of that on the head. But one of the things that really stuck to me, you said, Representative Cleavorn, was that money is how we fix housing. Well, this proposal, what Chair Howard and I put in, is actually going to promote cities to build out more housing without spending taxpayer dollars. And that is the importance of this amendment that's in here today. And you mentioned something about how lot size is not working with septic systems. Very familiar with that. That's like 70% of my district. It's not saying that they have to be one-eighth acre lots. It's just saying that the city needs to allow it. So maybe a developer wants to come in and tie in and build out the infrastructure to have a wastewater system that works for those smaller homes, that'd be affordable, that would be starter homes for people. And again, like my co-chair said, none of these are mandates. These are just that carrot that many of the groups around the state have been asking us for and saying, yep, we'll put a few more points in there if you start doing these things. And I think you'll discover that you're going to attract more development, you're going to attract more people, and you're going to grow your community in a way that's going to be productive and conducive for what we're trying to do here in Minnesota, which is have affordable and diverse housing for all Minnesotans to create stability for families here and make Minnesota the best place to live.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and co-chairs. Again, I don't disagree with what you were, the end product of more housing. Don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with the diversity of housing. I think that's awesome, right? But what I disagree with is that you're putting an additional scoring system without, if there's existing criteria that is required, then let's add it so that we know that this is subordinate to those other existing criteria. Because right now, that's not in the bill. It doesn't say that. Can't find it in statute. So if you want it to be subordinate, let it be subordinate. But you don't have that in your bill right now. The other thing I would say is it still causes an imbalance, whether you like it or not. And just because you say something is factual doesn't make it so. If you get more points, you get more dollars. That's how this is set up. Cities that can't get more points are then left behind. And if we want regional housing all across our state, then put it in the bill. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Representative Katisa Batun.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And first, I guess, I'm having trouble with my microphone here. I want to thank you and Chair Torkelson for providing an incredible target for the Housing Committee this year. I think that, you know, when we have conversations about quality of life in Minnesota and elsewhere, we have to go back to my high school psychology class and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And if you don't have a safe roof over your head, if you don't have somewhere to sleep at night, if you can't put food in your belly, the rest of life becomes tremendously difficult. And so I just wanted to start off with gratitude toward that. And then I'll direct my gratitude toward the co-chairs here. I think, you know, when we look at the trends in housing, particularly in rental prices here in the state of Minnesota, but particularly in the metro area, rent prices keep going up and up and up. And now suburban rent prices, including those in my city in Eden Prairie, are higher than downtown Minneapolis. Of course, Eden Prairie is a lovely place to live. I don't take issue with the fact that there's high demand to live there. However, I want people to be able to afford to live there. And so I think that when we look at what we need to do to expand our infrastructure and provide assistance to families who are potentially at danger of becoming unsheltered, and make sure that they have the support that they need so that their kids can get the education that they need, this is all really critical. So I really appreciate that you two have been able to work together and bring advocates and other committee members along the way. And I do want to express a little bit of concern from my mayor and my city council about some of the provisions that other colleagues have shared already earlier. And I think that we've still got more work to do on that. And I think that, but I do think an incentive approach is a good way to go. So I'll leave it at that. I would be remiss, though, if we don't put into greater context what is happening in the country right now. And I think, much to the chagrin of some of our colleagues across the aisle, the Trump administration is proposing to cut over $1 billion in affordable housing preservation money and Section 8 vouchers in particular. And as the co-chair of the Children and Families Committee, it ties very closely into how people can afford to live here and afford to feed their kids and send them to school and do all the things that we want to do in order to make Minnesota the best place to raise a family. But nationwide, there are about 2 million households that receive Section 8 housing vouchers right now. And that includes about 64,000 Minnesotans. And it's my best estimate that about 30,000 of those individuals are children. So I applaud you for doing all the work that you can do in the context of our state budget and this bill. But we need everybody to be advocating, including our congressional delegation, including our constituents. People need to be reaching out to the federal government and the Trump administration to explain exactly how disastrous these cuts would be for our neighbors here in Minnesota and all across the country. So again, my gratitude for the contents of this bill and the fact that we have money, state money, to make these investments. And we still have a lot more work to do.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering to the co-chairs, what in this bill is reducing regulation that goes into the cost of building a new home? We've seen the articles that it's 20% more in Minnesota to build a house, the same house as in Wisconsin. I look at, if you have a $400,000 house, let's just even go 15%, okay? If you have a $400,000 house, if the violation or the codes were reduced and the regulations were reduced by just 15%, that would shave $60,000 off the cost of that home. For a $350,000 house, it'd shave off $52,500. That would take a $350,000 house down to $297,000. How many more people would qualify for that? So what in this bill is attacking the overregulation that is happening in Minnesota as far as building a new home?
Chair Igo. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott. So I'd say the most pointed part of this bill that's going at what you just said there is what we just spent a lot of time discussing now, which is the amended language in Section 22 of the bill. The carrot approach to trying to get cities to open up their zoning to be more accessible to bring down the prices of homes. Now, we have done a lot of work, Chair Howard and I, along with some members in this room, on a Yes to Homes package of bills that is going to be accomplishing a lot of those things to bring down costs. Those are getting rid of aesthetic mandates. Those are getting rid of the requirements around HOAs. Those are getting rid of the land use requirements that are driving up the cost of housing. It's what's making Minnesota the most expensive place to buy a house. And unfortunately, because of the powers that be, we weren't able to put a lot of that stuff in the bill today. But those are the things that we are trying to accomplish, because that is how we get at the root cause of this and get away from state dollars investing in housing, but actually create policy that allows our developers and the free market and personal private property rights to soar and for housing costs to come down.
Chair Howard, did you want to add to that?
Chair Stevenson, Representative Scott, I would just say I agree, and I really appreciate the question. And I'm standing here as a Democrat that carried a bill that spent $1 billion in housing last year, and that bill is going to do a lot of good. It's going to build a lot of homes. But I'm also here to say public dollars will not solve our housing shortage. We need to unleash the private market and make it easier for more homes to be built and to target the regulation that you're talking about. There is too much regulation happening at the local level that is driving up the cost of homes. And so there is more work for us to do together. There's a small piece in here that Chair Igo mentioned that will help us do some of that, but we have more work to do.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I talk to my cities, what they tell me is there's, aside from this bill, there's a ton of regulation in building a house now that's state mandated, not at the local level, state mandated. So what I'll be doing between now and the time that this bill reaches the floor is getting some amendments put together that would repeal. I'm going to be talking to my cities. What are some of the regulations that we can repeal? Talking to home builders in my area, what are some of the regulations we can repeal that will make housing more affordable? And so it really has always really bothered me that through the years after we've had a committee that's solely dedicated to housing, that I've not seen bills that address that. Just putting more and more money, the 1.2 or whatever it was last year, billion, it doesn't seem to be solving the problem. And my second question, Mr. Chair, and I don't serve on that committee, but are there reports that we're going to be getting back for that $1.2 billion that was spent last year for housing? Will we be getting really meaty reports that tell whether that investment that we asked the people of Minnesota to make in housing affordability, whether it's working or not?
Since it was Chair Howard's bill, I'll put the question to him. Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative Scott. Yes. So we included a provision. Well, one, each program that Minnesota Housing funds is accompanied by a report that goes to the housing committees each year. But we specifically passed legislation in 2024 that mandated a report from MHFA basically on a full accounting and impact of what was passed in the 2023 budget.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the co-chairs. It's been a pleasure to be on this committee. And I'll say the bill does a nice job at a lot of things, but it still comes up very short in a lot of others. And I appreciate the amendment that we put on to do the carrot and stick, because we've been preaching about this for years and years and years, and we've been talking about ways to make housing more affordable, to get to the point where you can have a meaningful chipping away at the 106,000 housing unit deficit that we have in this state. And deregulation has to be a part of this equation. And you've all heard me talk about it on the floor about the quadratic equation of housing, and deregulation is a part of it. Simply spending money from the state is not the solution. We have to get the regulations that get put on at the state, to Chair Scott's, but also at the local levels. We have to get those out of the way if we are to expect that the free market is going to act like the free market and will solve the problems that we have at hand. Because for those of us that are sitting around this table that have kids and possibly grandkids, those people that we love don't have much of a chance to buy a house in the state that we love, that they grew up in. And that's wrong. That is really, really wrong. So if you live in the outstate, the problem is that you don't have enough people that want to come out there and build. If you live closer to the metro, you have the problem of you can't afford the land and you can't afford the labor, and that a lot of the regulations that are in place are adding to that cost on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. And the study that was put out a number of years ago by the National Association of Realtors said that for every $1,000 you add to the price of a house, you're pricing 4,000 potential buyers out of the market. For the love of Ludafisk, let's remove some of these things that add unnecessary costs and lump it into the house so that my kid, your kid, one day Representative Igo will have kids, that they can afford to buy a house in the state of Minnesota. Because otherwise, we're just admiring this problem and we're clutching our pearls and we're afraid of making a bold statement. It is time to be bold. Thank you.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the co-chairs for your work on this bill. I know you have all worked very hard, and I do not serve on the Housing Committee, so I just preface that by saying I may not know what I'm talking about. My concern is really in this amendment on, so I'm just going to ask the question, on sub 4 where it says that they cannot mandate lot sizes larger than 1/8, and in sub 3 it says they cannot have parking mandates greater than one stall per unit. But in some of the other sections, it says, you know, it applies to 75% of the area. But this seems to apply to the entire city. So they couldn't have anywhere in the city where they have more than one parking stall per unit that includes multifamily and single family. Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Igo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, yes, that would be correct. Yes, for your, if you're talking about line 3-5 through 3-6 there, yes, that would be for the city itself.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So my concern about this, and I understand wanting to cut down on maybe the number of cars in a community or traffic or whatever, but a lot of people who live in multifamily housing are not necessarily related. So, for example, I have three daughters who all have roommates, and it's a real hardship if only one of the roommates can have a car and they all need to get to work. So I'm just trying to understand how this will work in practice, whether it's single family or multifamily, and having raised three daughters, I also had, my husband and I each had a car, and then we had a car for our girls when they were growing up, so they could get to school, get to sports. So I'm just trying to understand, like, in practice, how is this going to work, and what is that going to do for families or singles who are just starting out in their lives? How are they going to actually get to work?
Chair Howard?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Representative Robbins, just want to recenter that no city would have to do any of these pieces, but these are things that some cities, large and small, have done and have seen work in their communities. So it's a menu of things that if a city chose to adopt a policy like this, they would be able to, you know, have a small scoring bump if a housing development project or MHFA was occurring in that municipality. So in terms of, like, you know, maybe some city decides this one doesn't work, but maybe we could look at that aesthetic mandate as a way to bring down the cost. There's choice and opportunity for the cities to decide in this amendment if they would like to pursue any of these policies.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And just to clarify again, but it would apply to the entire city, not just to a particular new development. Am I understanding the language here?
Chair Howard.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Roberts, yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
There's no further discussion, so we'll go to closing comments, first from Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. Would just end with gratitude to Chair Stevenson, to Chair Torkelson, again, for their work and our both of our caucuses' work. I think it reflects what is true, that housing is a top-tier issue in all of our communities. And we should be proud as a legislature that we've decided to make investments that will make a difference to build more homes and create more housing stability for Minnesotans from border to border. Thousands of Minnesotans' lives will be better as a result of this bill, and I look forward to our work on a bipartisan basis to move it forward this session.
And Chair Igo.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I'll also express that gratitude. Thank you for giving us the target that we're able to invest in all of Minnesota to protect affordability, diversity, and stability. I want to make one closing comment that was made. You know, we talk sometimes in this committee about what's happening at the national level. One of the things that was going to work at cutting those regulations that was brought up today is happening at the national level and has not been able to get across the finish line yet here in Minnesota, and that is land use and zoning reform. Everyone from Vice President Vance to Governor Newsom agree that we need to be doing these things now to bring down the cost of housing. It's working in states like Florida. It's working in states like Colorado. Red and blue states on both sides of the spectrum have implemented the things that Chair Howard and I have been working on that could make the difference here in Minnesota. And they're not in the bill today. So back to Representative Scott's question, you're right. We've been trying to do more to cut regulations to bring down the cost of housing. They couldn't get here to that bill today, but we're going to keep working on it. But right now, the bill we have in front of us is a small approach to start giving that carrot to the cities that have asked for that, and really to invest all across this state and to try and move the needle on addressing this housing shortage that we have. So thank you, members, for the time today.
All right, thank you. And with that, Chair Igo renews his motion that House File 2445 be laid over and the bill is laid over. Members, I just want to check before we move to our next bill. We had talked about having a brief recess. I don't think that's necessary. I'm just looking at my counterpart to make sure. All right, so we will proceed to the Commerce Finance Bill, House File 2443. And as Chairs O'Driscoll and Herr make their way down, I will move that House File 2443 be laid over. And then I will turn to Ms. Adrians to mention what the target is for this committee and whether the bill is in compliance with the target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the Commerce Finance Committee, the target that they received was $3 million over the base amount for fiscal years 26 and 27. And then in the tails, the target was a reduction of $10 million for the fiscal years 28 and 29. And the bill is in compliance with these numbers.
Great. And now we'll move to a presentation from the chairs. Chair Herr.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Co-Chair Torkelson. Unlike housing, we did not get a big target. So we worked with what we got, and what is in front of you is a compromised budget that Representative O'Driscoll and I worked on together. This bill, we think that is a good representation of where both of us stand on what we think is the right thing to put forward. It does fund our department, the Commerce Department, to what it was what they recommended for us, but also OCM to almost the recommended changes that they were asking for, and that we did have to make some cuts in the tails, but we also understand that that is the nature that's in front of us, and most of that cut came from our CAN renewal grants, and so we look forward to having more detailed conversations with committee members today on what has been proposed and put forward in front of all of you.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Torkelson. As Co-Chair Herr said, we did not have as big a target as maybe some of the other committees that you have in front of you. But we are pleased with what we're bringing forward. I think, as Chair Herr said, is a compromise. And unlike Chair Herr, I'm not really looking forward to hearing your questions. So I'm going to defer all of them to Co-Chair Herr today.
Noted. There is an amendment, an author's amendment, the A6 amendment. I will move the A6 amendment on behalf of Chair Herr. And Chair Herr, if you want to describe the A6.
Yes, thank you, Chair Stevenson. So this is a technical amendment. It reflects updated revenue projections for the securities assessment. It does not impact our target, so there is no budget impact on this. These are just technical changes and updating figures that we didn't have earlier, but they're more accurate now with this amendment.
Discussion to the A6. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was reading through the bill and then, again, the amendment, a piece of the bill came to my attention It's subdivision, or it's section 5 on page 12, lines 1.29 through the balance of the bill. And it is a task force on homeowners and commercial property insurance. Task forces, and I came to this conclusion after I listened to both Representative Cleavorn and Representative Akam talk about the fact that certain things didn't make it to certain committees. This neither made it to state government finance, local government, or housing, and yet it's a provision that, at least for the state gov piece, has a task force managed by the LCC. So that didn't make it to the state government finance committee, didn't make it to housing because I'm on housing, and I checked with our staff, and it did not make it to state, to local government either. And I'm just wondering why that might have been.
Representative Herr?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So we did have conversation with, and I had conversations with DFL staff on this, in that for the mere mention of LCC and it being a task force, it does not have to go to state government. This didn't go to housing because this has less to do with housing, more to do with insurance and really looking at HOAs and the impact of that, and also on property and casualty, on the increasing in insurance cost. And so after discussion, this bill came directly to Commerce, and so it did not go to the other departments. Co-Chair O'Driscoll and I have had discussions on this, and we both felt that where it is now is the correct jurisdiction was Commerce to oversee this.
Anything to add, Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my comments generally echo those of Chair Herr. The fact that this was an insurance bill, that's where it is. Commerce is the jurisdiction for that. Local government, I don't know that it would necessarily fit there. Again, it has to do with the insurance industry no more than any other kind of insurance product. That might be an automobile or another type of insurance coverage that would go to local government on that as well. We did do some checking, and it has come back with us and to us that, as Chair Herr said, doesn't automatically, because it references the Legislative Coordinating Commission mandate, an automatic referral to that committee, and no one caught it along the way, and this has been something that we've been working on for quite a while in Commerce, and we're checking out. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would encourage a support by the committee for the amendment offered today.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to the author, can you tell me the approximate cost of the task force that is in the bill?
Chair Herr.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Nash, it's $200,000 for each year of the biennium.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I'm sorry, Representative O'Driscoll.
And members, if you'd like to, on your spreadsheets, it is line 9, and you'll see that under the 2025 appropriation, because we wanted to get that moving as quickly as we can, not necessarily wait for the new biennium.
Apologize for interrupting you, Representative Nash. I just wanted to give Representative O'Driscoll a chance to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
A $200,000 task force is not a de minimis amount. It's a fairly expensive task force, and again, I think it was Chair Cleavorn that said more eyes make something better here just a few minutes ago, and I would tend to agree with her on this, that this definitely should have come before state government to at least talk about the LCC having to manage a new task force. So I'm not going to try to amend anything out. I'm just pointing out that this I don't believe was the best look for us, and that we could have done a lot better as it relates to how we put a new task force into existence. Once again, I think that my phone always rings when someone calls it, and it would have been great to hear about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, and I just this is just kind of general to the committee as a whole for the LCC. In past years, we have seen where appropriations are not adequate for the LCC, or the task force runs for a longer period of time than the appropriation is allowed, and then it becomes a state government cost. So I will be looking at all the bills coming through to make sure that those costs are in fact covered. And when you have 16 members on and everybody is qualified for per diem, I think sometimes one of the ways that we can make sure that this doesn't happen, that we don't run out of money, is to make sure that those people who are just doing their normal job, and this is something that they would do in the normal course of their job, be exempted from the per diem provisions. But that's just for the committee as a whole. Thank you.
No further discussion. All those in favor of the A6 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and A6 is adopted. Discussion and questions to the underlying bill. Seeing no discussion, we'll give closing comments first to Chair O'Driscoll.
Great bill, vote yes.
And then to Chair Hur.
Ditto, great bill, vote yes.
All right, and with that, I'll renew the motion to lay over House File 2443, and the bill is laid over. As amended, the bill is laid over. Our next bill is House File 2439, the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Bill, and as chairs make their way to the table, I'll turn to Ms. Adrians and ask her to state the target for this committee and whether the bill is in compliance with the target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Environment Finance Committee received a target of a reduction of $10 million for fiscal years 26 and 27, and then the target in the tails was no change from the February forecast base for 28 and 29, and the bill is in compliance with these targets.
And now I'll turn to Chair Heintzman to describe the bill. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you is a bare bones budget bill for the environment area. All fund spending for the biennium in this bill is $2.284 billion. The base for the general fund for the biennium is $435 million and change. As was just mentioned, we had a $10 million target cut. And this bill does meet that target at $425 million from the general fund. Co-chair Fisher and I worked to reach agreement on a number of provisions, but unfortunately we were left with a more challenging proposition. And so there are no policy items in the bill. I will note that we did not do any of the major agency funding increase requests. In particular, there were over $31 million in operating increases and over $16 million in fee increases that were asked for. We did agree to backfill our $10 million cut by reducing unspent appropriations from the 2023 budget bill as follows. I'll go through those. Quickly, $3 million reduction from the MPCA for a local government climate resiliency and water infrastructure grant program, $2 million reduction from Bowser for a climate resiliency adaption program, and finally, a $5 million reduction from the DNR for a wetland prairie grassland restoration on state-owned land program. And I will turn it over to my co-chair at this time.
And before I do that, I skipped an important step, which was moving the bill before the committee. So Chair Heintzman will move that House File 2439 be laid over.
That's
Chair
correct,
Fisher,
Mr. Chair.
You can,
thank you.
Yeah, Chair Fisher, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to co-chair Heintzman. A couple other things I wanted to mention on the bill is that we did have one small area where there was an increase. It's an air appropriation increase, and this is required by the Federal Clean Air Act and state statute that requires the agency to charge fees to cover the cost of air emissions permitting and to include an inflationary amount in those fees. Outside of that, the other change that we had out there was the closed landfill investment fund is making sure that we authorize that to have spending out of that for the next 4 years. The current spending was supposed to end at the end of June 30th, and with closed landfills, there will be issues that will continue into the future, and so this just allows for continued spending to address those issues.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. There were no amendments to the bill, so we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I really just wanted to thank the two chairs and just note that I assume that each of them and their caucuses had things they really want to do in this space. This is an area where there's significant disagreement. As somebody who and I get along very well with my co-chair, but we're you know one of those bills that we're still that still being worked on, and there's several others. And so I think we should praise these two chairs for their work. As disappointing, I'm sure there's some pieces you each would have wanted to move forward, and also recognizing the position that we're in of advancing this bill forward at this time, I think is a great achievement. So grateful to both of you. Thank you, Chair.
Further discussion. Seeing no further discussion, we'll move to closing comments. Representative Fisher.
Thank,
Yes. I'm going to go. I'll give you both and just. It's your bill, Chair Heintzman, so I was going to finish up the gun.
No, I want to say a big thank you to Co-Chair Heintzman, and I think Chair Pinto very much highlighted that. You know, there was a lot of things that we look forward to. At the same time, realized that we had a lot of limits out there. We realized that we want to make sure that we got things done so that we could move forward. This is a bonding year, or excuse me, a budget year. We want to make sure to work together to get that done. I want to say thank you to Chair Heintzman and his side for working together to get us to where we are. It wasn't easy, but we know we knew the work we had to do, and we worked together to do it. I appreciate his work.
Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo that sentiment and glad that we were able to get to this point and look forward to the next steps.
Yep.
Wonderful. And with that, Chair Heintzman renews his motion that House File 2349 be laid over and the bill is laid over. The next item on our agenda is House File 3023 from Representative Johnson. As Representative Johnson comes forward, I will move that House File 3023 be placed on the general register. Representative Johnson, when you are situated, you can present your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 3023 is something that's probably familiar to a lot of you folks. This bill was, similar bill to this was carried by Representative Dave Lizegard in 2023 that did a very similar thing to a very similar impacted group of workers. House File 3023 will extend unemployment insurance benefits for an additional 26 weeks after all their initial unemployment benefits are exhausted to the mine workers directly impacted by the temporary closure of two mines operated by Cleveland Cliffs, the Minorca mine in Virginia and the Hibtac mine in Hibbing. This will impact approximately 600 workers at those mines, as well as the employees from the explosives manufacturing industry. While this bill does have significant impact on those workers, it also has major impacts for those communities at large. The goal of this extension is to get workers from being forced out of their communities and search for work so that when those mines reopen, there are workers available. Short intro, that's happy to take any questions folks have.
All right, before we move to questions, I'm just going to ask Ms. Adrians to comment on the fiscal note and confirm there is no general fund cost here. This is a cost to a different fund.
That's correct, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You should have a fiscal note in your packets, and what it shows is that this is an estimate of the potential impact if all, as the bill author stated, if the 600 workers were to participate in the unemployment insurance program, and it cites an amount that would be a weekly benefit amount for 26 weeks. The potential cost of that would be just under $15 million in fiscal year 26. And it is not an impact on the general fund, but rather an impact on the unemployment insurance fund.
Discussion to the bill. Discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, as you were making your introduction, you had said that this was similar to Representative Lizegard bill from the past, but I'm noticing as I peruse House File 3030 that it is the exact same language as Representative Igoe's bill. Is that correct?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. There is one change from Representative Igoe's bill that was 3030, and that was the removal of, I believe it was subdivision, hang on here, 5, the charging of benefits.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just as something that we should do here is also recognize the work of some of our fellow members. Representative Igoe worked extremely hard to get this across the finish line, worked with endless numbers of interested groups to gain their support. Just as a friendly word that you should also do a tip of the cap to someone like Representative Igoe, who's done an amazing amount of work to get this thing done. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just wondering, is this cost socialized or does it go back to the employer?
Representative Johnson.
Could you explain what your question is?
Representative Rarick.
In socialized, I guess.
So if you understand unemployment insurance, there's two ways to pay for a $15 million cost to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. One is socialized, which means every employer in the state of Minnesota pays for it through increases in their rates, or like a premium, or the cost goes back to the employers that laid all of these 600 or 700 people off. And which is it in the bill?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. This would go back to those employers.
Representative Rarick.
Okay, so the cost goes back to the employers that have laid everybody off, so it's not socialized.
I think that's what you said, yeah. Okay. Do you have any other questions?
That's just highly unusual. Okay. Usually it's socialized.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this forward. I kind of want to clarify a little bit about the separate bills that were referenced. Your bill, House File 3023, the one before us, contains the unemployment insurance extension. Then there's a bill with actually a higher number, House File 3030 from Representative Igo, that contains the unemployment insurance extension, but also some provisions, some environmental provisions. I do understand and respect Representative Igo was working on that bill. I appreciate that. In fact, that bill, the bill with the higher number, was heard in the Jobs Committee, and I just want to make sure we're clear that the opportunity was given to have that bill advance in a form that would have become law on what is now House File 3023. Our GOP colleagues at that time rejected an amendment that would have made that change, which is fine. That was theirs to do. Representative Johnson, I appreciate you moving forward with this bill to make sure that we are, in fact, extending the unemployment insurance for these minors. But I do just want to recognize that I think you, Representative Johnson, at every point have been very willing to work. In fact, so much so that you actually offered an amendment that would have allowed Representative Igo's bill to be the bill that would have advanced. And that was rejected at that time, and that's kind of why we're here. So I do just kind of want to set the record straight that I know you've been willing to work at every point, and we are where we are, that your bill is now the one that's going to be getting it done. But I know that you're very willing and have had multiple conversations. I appreciate that work. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is clearly a Representative Igo bill. We made some changes to the bill for Representative Johnson. Again, I want to say, you know, for both of you, this is important to get done. We did see some last-minute oral amendments, I think, too, just to make sure we get the bill crafted so it was actually going to do the unemployment insurance that we needed to do here for this. So, again, I just, as a new member here, Representative Johnson, this is something that's important to do, is to recognize other members. And we've been doing this a lot this session, just to make sure that we are carrying the water this way. This is how this happens. We had a room full for 2 days for one bill and then basically a clone bill the next one. What's missing still in this session is to make sure that we give our iron workers a lot of room for what is next then, when we don't get these mines are not reopening as quickly as we want them to do. We need to have new work done and new permitting requirements. We need to get on this, and we need to get serious with that. So again, thank you for bringing this forward. We all supported it in committee at the end of the day, but this has been a lot of work by a couple different members, so I just want to recognize that as well. Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Johnson and Representative Igo for working on this. I think it's really important to expand this unemployment insurance for our minors. We've done this multiple times in the past, and it's nice to see everybody so excited about protecting our workers. I've heard phrases sometimes of UI is just paying for people to stay home and not work. So I just want to highlight the fact that I think all of us in this room really care about making sure our workers are taken care of when something like a mine unexpectedly shuts down. So thank you so much.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, thanks for the bill in front of us today. I just want to walk us through how we got to this point. As the member whose district was affected by this, I just want to tell everyone the story of how this all went. When we found out, it would be 3 weeks ago now, and we found out, or excuse me, 4 weeks ago, that 640 steelworkers were losing their jobs. That's a hard day for not just our state, that's a hard day for every single person on the Iron Range. The work that went in to getting us to the point of where we have language in front of us was extensive. I can't tell you how many phone calls I've taken from steelworkers, how many sit-down meetings I've had, how many stories I've heard. Now, I do want to talk about, obviously, full-heartedly going to support this bill today. I think everyone in this room is going to support this bill today. We should. Unemployment benefits being extended right now is more important than ever, and I'm glad that we have it in front of us. But the reason that my bill has two other provisions that take up three pages is because I took both the presidents of the locals who were affected. We sat in my office for an hour, and I said, what can we do to make sure you have jobs in the future? And we came up with the two things that were in the bill, that are in my bill. One would be for reactive mine waste, and one would be for the site-specific standard for sulfides. Two things that aren't cutting regulations in the state, two things that aren't making it easier for our mind to operate in the state, but two things that would actually put science into state law so that our miners would have a future doing what they do best, which is mining. And that's why we crafted the bill the way we did. And I sat down and I looked at them and I said, at any point, if you want to pull back the two other environmental provisions and just focus on UI, you say it and it's done. Well, members, I'm still here carrying 3030 and was just with dozens of members of the local at Minorca last week who said, Spence, keep the work up. We need these environmental changes so we have a future for our kids. Members, I challenge you to sit in a room where members who just got laid off, who don't have a job, are bringing their kids and are standing there listening to you asking, what are you going to do to help us? And when I say I got unemployment coming, they say that's great, but it isn't going to make a difference if they don't have a job when it runs out. So I apologize for getting a little emotional and powerful about this, but it really matters. So it's great we can all sit here and say, yeah, we're going to extend unemployment benefits. But when they run out in May of next year and the mines still aren't open because this state won't open its eyes and do what's right for the people of Greater Minnesota, then what's the point of all of this? It's really, really hard to take it on the chin and be told, oh, you're going to get your unemployment extension and it's going to be great. These families, these men and women, these union men and women want an opportunity to keep doing what they've done for 140 years the best way. And nothing in my bill would make it worse for water standards, for environmental standards, for labor standards. It would actually be putting stricter standards on the industry. Because if it was going to cut regulations and we were going to pollute our waters, I'd be the first person on the picket line, along with every single one of my constituents, to shut down any operation that would threaten that. I speak for every single person on Minnesota's Iron Range when I say that. So again, I'm glad we have a UI bill in front of us today. I'm glad we're going to get this extension done. It's important. But please don't forget the other things that are important. And that's jobs and a sustainable future for the men and women of Minnesota's Iron Range who live and work every day to provide the things that you use in your daily life.
Closing comments, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today. Appreciate the conversations that I have had with Spencer or Representative Igo on this bill. Look forward to working with him on some other issues to address some of the other impacted folks up on the range to figure out how we can make sure that this extension isn't impacting and hitting all the folks that it's supposed to impact. I appreciate your support and look forward to further conversation.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3023 be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and House File 3023 is recommended be placed on the general register. The last bill on the agenda today is mine, so we will have a little switcheroo here.
Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill, House File 1615, to be placed on the general register?
So moved.
Chair Stevenson moves that his bill, House File 1615, be placed on the general register. The bill is now before us. Chair Stevenson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the cannabis policy bill, and ordinarily a policy bill does not find its way to the Ways and Means Committee. There is one provision in this bill that has a small savings to the state of $246,000 in the first biennium and $480,000 in the tails, and that's why this provision comes to this committee. We have agreed, Chair Torkelson and I, to include that within the commerce target, and in fact, the commerce bill that we heard earlier today relies upon these savings in part to reach its target this year. I'll speak just to the provision that brings the bill before the Ways and Means Committee, understanding that the policy provisions are not ordinarily discussed in, or wouldn't come to Ways. The provision that carries the savings is a new license for low-dose THC wholesalers. Members, these are the products, the beverages and the gummies, other things like that. When we passed House File 100 in 2023 that legalized adult use cannabis. We instituted a new licensing regime for the low-dose products that had already been made legal in 2022. Essentially, we were putting some guardrails around that industry. We created a retailing license. We created a manufacturing license. We did not create a wholesaling license. What has happened is, in particular, the beverages have become incredibly popular. A lot of breweries across Minnesota are making those beverages. In fact, a lot of breweries have come up and told me they would be out of business but for these low-dose beverages. And I encourage members to talk to your local breweries about that. You'll find that a lot of them are struggling, and this has been a lifesaver for them. And then wholesalers, beer wholesalers, liquor wholesalers, and other entities got into this business as well. But as we go forward, the only option if you are a wholesaler, if you want to continue selling these products under existing law, is to get a cannabis wholesale license, which is a problem if you're a beer wholesaler, because cannabis is still illegal on a federal level. And so if you get a cannabis license, you put at risk your tax status at a federal level. So we need a separate license that's just for the low-dose products, and that's why we included that provision in this bill, which is what brings it before Ways and Means. And so, Madam Chair, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. There are no amendments to this bill, so we'll move on to member discussion. First on the list is Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested, roll call will be done. Any other member questions before we get to Chair Gomez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just ask a question that's not about the provision that brings us before Ways, if that's okay with the Chair.
One question.
Go ahead, Representative Gomez.
I was actually addressing the other chair, but thank you, Madam Chair. So obviously, when we conceived of this bill, one of the main things driving us was just a recognition of the damage that has been done to communities across the country by the war on drugs, the failed war on drugs, and the collateral consequences and direct consequences of that war on drugs. And so we obviously worked hard to try to figure out how to ensure that the benefits that came out of legalizing cannabis didn't just accrue to, you know, big multi-state operations, that we were trying to figure out, you know, in the context of a lot of uncertainty, I think, how to recognize those communities that had been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs and to attempt to get some of those benefits into those communities. And so I guess I'm just looking at the change in the ownership for social equity applicants. And you know, so originally we had it at 100%, I think, and then it was evident that that was creating a barrier in accessing financing, and so that was brought down to 65, and then this brings it further down, not at the initial time, but when and if the license gets transferred from one person to another one. That it lowers the threshold for the percentage of social equity applicants that have to be part of the ownership group. And just, you know, I guess my experience of participating in this bill a lot early and then kind of seeing, you know, as it you do a bunch of work and then it kind of goes into the world and it changes. And, you know, there's a lot of litigation and other kind of exogenous factors that are impacting this. It's not just the decisions that we're making around these tables, but that it's the fact that the cannabis industry is a very large and powerful industry, and there are certain interests that have a lot of access to resources and to lawyers, and I just see the erosion of some of the decisions that we made in our attempt to try to target some of the benefits of cannabis legalization to those disproportionately impacted communities. And I guess I'm just, you know, accepting that we're going, this is kind of like a moving thing and we're going to have to adapt it, but I just, when I see something like this, I'm concerned about it, and I'm curious about what the, why 65 to 51, or what's the, sorry, that was a long way to ask that question, but thank you, Chair, Madam Chair.
Yes, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Gomez, and I think that you articulated very well the sort of philosophical underpinnings behind the original bill, and I also want to, you said this, but just so that people are clear, we're not talking here about when the license issues, what you have to do to get a social equity, to be a social equity applicant and get that license. The question is, if you went later to sell the license, what percentage of the ownership structure that you are selling to has to qualify as a social equity applicant? And I think, I was trying to remember, I think at one point we were at 100%, and I think it came down to 65 later, and now this bill would change it to 51. And whenever we have a discussion about this, you're balancing two interests. And you articulated one very well about a desire to concentrate benefits on people who were disadvantaged by the prior regulatory regime. The balancing interest is that you have people who are these social equity applicants who are creating a business, trying to create wealth, create something of value that improves their economic condition. And if you limit the pool of people that they can sell their business to, you are limiting the value of the enterprise to them. And so whenever we've discussed this over the years that I've been involved with it, there's been tension between those two goals. And in fact, you will hear from people who are social equity applicants a desire to see this come down. And I'm sure there are others who think it should stay high. It's also an issue where we're picking a number here. And, it, you know, is there anything magical about 65 versus 60 versus 70 versus whatever? It's hard to come to it. But the idea, I think, behind this policy proposal is to allow a little more flexibility. It's also worth saying that you have to hang on. You can't sell right away once you accrue the license, because that would be concerning, right, if you could immediately turn around. And I think that gets to what you were talking about, the power of the industry. But this is after a waiting period, and I left my bill up at the front, so I can't tell you the 5 years. Yeah, I don't have it in front of me. But so it's not right away. There's also an effective date that's a year out on this change, and it's also something that I think we can continue to talk about. But that's, I think, the thinking about this is, you know, once someone has this entity and they've invested in it and they've grown some value, how much do we want to restrict their ability to sell it and generate wealth?
Yeah.
Chair Gomez.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Stevenson, for walking through that with us. You know, I think this is one of those, like, many situations that we find ourselves in as policymakers where we're making decisions in the context of a certain amount of uncertainty and imperfect information. And, you know, I appreciate the thought that has gone into it and that we can continue to talk about this and make sure that it's at the right level. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just picking up on Representative Gomez's question, 51% a social equity applicant still retains control of their business. And I would say it only helps them to allow them to sell more of their business, as Chair Stevenson pointed out. There is another way to approach this, which I know it's off topic, but we have the true party of interest limits that only allow 10% of a license to be owned if you want to own multiple licenses, which is also a barrier to investment for these new social equity applicants. Addressing that threshold could be another way we could help them maybe not go to 51%, we keep it at 65%, but we allow other entities to own up to 30% so they can supply the capital that is so needed in this industry and help those who are affected. So that is just a random aside. Yeah, this bill is still a work in progress. We have a number of issues to address. And on the wholesaler provisions that are within the bill, and then there is a exporter provision that needs to be incorporated in there. And then we also need to make sure we're preserving the market for our medical patients going forward, and we have a tiny start on that, but could continue to look at that and expand it so that we can ensure everybody can maintain access to their medications. But I will be supporting this bill out of committee, but I believe those issues will need to be addressed down the line.
Chair Stevenson, any comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Nor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to get clarification on the qualification, whether it's the renewal or the application under page 38, line 38.19 to 38.21. I don't know if I can get some help from the nonpartisan staff, because I've had this is for the current existing owners, and it looks like it's the applicant or the application.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson is coming
up.
Mr.
Johnson.
But I think this is what we were just, Madam Chair,
yes.
I could, I think this is what we were just talking about. And I'll let Mr. Johnson elaborate further.
Mr. Johnson, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, it's Ben Johnson from House Research. Representative Noor, members, I believe the question that you're asking about is about this 51%. That change is on page 38 at line 20. This does apply to the qualifications for being a social equity applicant, so it would apply at the time of application, not only later at the time of a transfer of the license. There is a delayed effective date that that provision does not become effective until July 1st, 2026.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll say that I'm opposed to any changes that go back after the applicants, because that was not the intention, as I've had from the testimony right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I think that is not the intention, so I think we'll have to continue to work on that as this bill moves forward.
Thank you. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, so the way it reads, it does read like that, but the way that the Office of Cannabis Management does their licensing rounds, this still wouldn't apply to. Like, there won't be new applicants until the Office of Cannabis opens up a new licensing round. So it wouldn't, the way Chair Stevenson described it is pretty accurate in the sense that for existing applicants, after they clear the waiting period that's in law, they could sell their business up to this point, and it does apply for applications, but there would have to be a licensing round for that application to for that to be an option. And as of right now, we just finished our first one. Lord willing, we can get this market started, but we'll see.
Chair Stevenson.
So, Madam Chair, I think what you're hearing from both Representative Chair West and myself is the intent is to apply towards transfers. So that's the intent. And as Chair West said, there's a couple other stages left in this bill, and there's some work in progress. And so we will make sure that the intent aligns with the bill language.
Thank you. Okay. Any other comments from members? I will just say I myself will also be looking to see how the bill updates as it moves through the committee and amendment process to ensure that everything lines up the way it should. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is that you made the motion that this was going to the GR, to the General Register, so
yes.
It's not going through other committees?
Well, it won't be going through other committees, but there are still amendments that will that can show up if it meets on the floor. So that's the discussions I think that Representative West and Chair Stevenson were talking towards, that there will probably be other amendments to this bill.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
thank Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. So Chair Stevenson, if you still have work to do, why don't we just lay this bill over and you could work on it at least in here instead of sending it to the floor and then do four amendments?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So this is not a policy committee, and I don't think it's appropriate to do the work in this committee. We will continue to work on a floor amendment or a conference committee are appropriate ways to make sure that the language is meeting the intent.
Representative Rick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Or you could send it back to the Committee of Jurisdiction so you could work on it there. Is there a reason? I mean, I guess we're past deadline, so. Sounds like there's a lot of work to do yet on this bill. That's kind of what I'm hearing. So I'm just concerned that we're going to be doing the committee work on the floor, which we all have concerns about. So I'll just put that out there. It's up to you. You're the chair of this committee, and you are the author of the bill. But I have concerns that we're doing our work that should have been done in the Committee of Jurisdiction, trying to do it in Ways and Means, and now we're going to do it on the floor. So I have concerns.
Chair Stevenson, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your time hearing the bill. Today I ask for a yes vote.
There being no further discussion of House File 1615, Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1615 will be placed on the General Register. Roll call having been requested, a roll call will be taken. Clerk, please proceed.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Chair Stevenson, aye. Chair Torkelson.
No.
Chair Torkelson, no. Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Vice Chair Agbaje, aye. Vice Chair Robbins.
No.
Vice Chair Robbins, no. Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Akam, aye. Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Baker, no. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Representative Bierman, aye. Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Gomez, aye. Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Heintzman, no. Representative Igo.
No.
Representative Igo, no. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle, aye. Representative Katizia-Watun.
Aye.
Representative Katizia-Watun, aye. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick, no. Representative Kreisha.
No.
Representative Kreisha, no.
Kinski, no.
Representative.
Sweet. You want to just count that now?
Yeah. Representative Swadzinski, aye. No. Representative. Representative Swadzinski.
Now, Chris.
Swadzinski, no.
Representative Swadzinski, no.
We got you.
All four times.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lilly, aye. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Moeller, aye. Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Nash, no. Representative Knorr.
Aye.
Representative Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, no. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Rarick.
No.
Representative Rarick, no. Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Schumacher, no. Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Scott, no. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative West.
Aye.
Representative West, aye. Representative Joachim.
Yes.
Representative Joachim, aye.
There being 15 ayes and 13 noes, the motion prevails and the bill is sent to the General Register. I don't think we have any other further business, Chair Stevenson. So with no further business before the committee, we are adjourned. Chair Tolson, do you want to say anything? No? Okay. Thank you. We are adjourned. My wonderful.